Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. First up, I'm talking to Stephen Atkinson from Port Augusta. He was involved with the Shutdown Australia campaign that took place yesterday in all capital cities here and in some places, some international communities as well. Stephen, welcome to the program. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good. Thank you, Tiger. Great to be here, mate.
Yes, thank you for giving us some of your time. You are on the job at work, but I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. Tell me your mob, your country.
Yeah, well, over here in Port Augusta, I'm a Bungala man in my mother's country here and connected to the Gugula and Wurrungal. But I'm also on my father's side, the Bungarang man from the Murray River, the sort of central, north central Victoria and south central New South Wales, along the Murray there. So, yeah, I'm quite happy to be in my mother's country at the moment.
Very good, very good. Tell me, Stephen, Shutdown Australia campaign, you had all capital cities were mobilised yesterday. What brought this about? What is Shutdown Australia and what's the purpose? What are you raising awareness for?
Well, it's raising awareness about the forced closures of communities in WA and also what's going on in I think almost all Aboriginal communities across the country now, since the government's trying to hand back responsibility of Aboriginal communities to the states and territory, as we know as well. So we're trying to raise awareness to that. The whole idea of the shutdown actually came from Port Augusta, from a local woman in Port Augusta who actually has been administering an Aboriginal community for the last 8 years voluntarily. So it really meant a lot to her that we were able to do what we done yesterday in Port Augusta. But the whole idea was that it wasn't just a protest or a shutdown as such. We called it a 60-minute strike, a 60-minute strike for the 60,000-plus-year-old culture.
All right.
Yeah, it was a great thing.
All right. And it was reasonably well attended in Port Augusta?
We had at least 500 to 600 people march up onto the bridge, and we effectively shut down the bridge for an hour. So that was the 60-minute strike, was to sit on the bridge and shut down the transport industry and everything else, because Port Augusta is quite a strategic place to do it, as it is the gateway to the desert, to the north and the south, east and west from here. There's only one bridge that connects up South Australia with the rest of the country from here. So it really had a great impact.
Very good. And reports from other parts of other capital cities?
I know Canberra had a great showing there. Sydney done one in Redfern, which was well attended. Melbourne, actually, the war, they call themselves, the Warriors of Aboriginal Resistance in Melbourne, went and shut down Rio Tinto's office, went and done a sit-in on Rio Tinto's office in solidarity with the shutdown. So there was different things happening right across the country. I know Brisbane also done one up there, and I know they had a fair mob there in the city doing their part as well.
So you're pretty happy with the results overall?
Overall, we're really ecstatic. I mean, the idea coming from a woman who works and is the CEO of a community here, and I mean, Port Augusta's not a huge place, but for her little idea that came out of the march protest in Adelaide to be taken on and done internationally, I think for her is a great thing of pride. And I know for Port Augusta, I think it's possibly a turning point in Port Augusta to do with, you know, getting that political mindset and getting the story out there for others to hear, because we didn't only just have Aboriginal protesters, we had a lot of non-Indigenous protesters as well with us, standing in solidarity. We had the Democrats, the Democrat Party, and also the Communist Party come up from Adelaide and stand in solidarity with us. So it really did make a big impact right across the board for the whole of the community here.
Stephen, what are the threats of community closures in South Australia? Like, how serious are these threats? Is it just talk? Have you seen anything in writing or in meetings, been told anything in meetings?
Well, I know for a fact they've cut back funding to all communities right across the country. I mean, Davenport and wife Levine, Ngātirua, her name is, whose idea it was, and why she's been the CEO of Davenport community here in Port Augusta for the last 8 years is because they cut the funding in Davenport 8 years ago. So she hasn't had a paid position, but she's done it out of the love of her heart, growing up on Ngāmi Waka Mission and in Davenport community all her life. It's really close to her heart. So, but on top of that, there's been talk, I know, in the APY lands, and the government have brought out reports recently that all the schools will be closing in those regions. So they're not actually closing the communities or being direct in closing the communities. I believe they're trying to do it by stealth. So what they're trying to do is close the schools in the APY lands and force children to go to regional areas such as Alice Springs, Coober Pedy, Port Augusta or wherever to do their schooling, which is in effect going to, you know, split the families up. So I believe the families will then be almost forced into moving with their children to these regional areas and going off communities. On top of that, the government have also just enforced a new CDEP type program throughout the remote areas of South Australia and other states, where the people in these regions will have to work 25 hours a week for 52 weeks of the year. Now, why they are doing that in remote areas, it's got me dumbfounded in reality, because in regional areas, the CDEP is only 26 hours for 6 months of the year. But they're forcing the people in the remote areas, such as the APY, to do 25 hours for 52 weeks of the year, which is effectively going to remove them again from country, because they will not be able to find the enough work in those remote areas, because there's not that much work up there for everyone to be doing 25 hours a week. So then they will be forced to move to regional areas to again be able to fulfil the government's CDEP roles. So this is why I say they're closing communities by stealth now. It's not direct, as you know, at least with Colin Barnett coming out in WA, he came out and said, we're going to close 150 communities of the 270-odd in Western Australia, and he said it outright, so we knew what we were dealing with. I think they're being a lot more sneaky, and we don't know how they're going to do it. They're bringing in these different little legislations and policies, forcing us to do things which will effectively remove people from communities.
Well, that CDP project or program must be a breach of industrial relations law. People do. I mean, there's annual leave, there's different things, there's superannuation. I don't think that's been taken into account. There's a range of things that, and I'm sure it's a breach of industrial relations law. Oh, it's.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
So it would possibly mean dialogue and engagement with unions to take that up, I might imagine.
Yeah, quite possibly. Mm. I mean, in effect, they could be pushing people, because a lot of the work in those, or close to those remote areas, would be mining. So they could be pushing people into the mining sector to do work for the dole, which in reality is slave labour. when you look at it.
You're right there.
For the people in remote communities. So it's crazy what they're up to.
And as if the mining sector needs any slave labour. I mean, there's hundreds of billions of dollars in profit in mining. They certainly don't need anybody working for the dole out there.
No, you wouldn't think so.
That's outrageous. The school thing, do you think some of the communities might say, well, if you're going to close our school, we're not moving anywhere, we're staying on country, we'll just have to get by without schooling or try and teach the kids as best we can? What are their options?
Well, yeah, that could come into play. But again, if they've already got policy in place that if children aren't being schooled, then the families lose their welfare entitlements.
Yeah, right.
So it's really going to make it hard for people to survive in that case in remote areas.
Yes, no, it seems these governments are out of control and don't give a damn about the rights, the human rights, particularly of First Nations peoples.
Yeah, definitely not. And I think this is why us standing in solidarity with the remote areas is going to be really important from here on in. I'd like to do a call out to all people, you know, listening and everywhere across Australia to start to understand the difficulties that our people are being pushed through these racist government policies and start to stand up with everyone else in their regions, whoever's doing protests, whoever's standing up and making a call to action, that we all get involved and we all start standing up for our people, because we like the song says, I suppose, stand up and be counted.
Yeah.
Because we've all got people, or we know people in remote areas, and you know, a lot of people have got family in these areas, so we need to all be supporting them.
Well, Stephen, how do you feel as a First Nations man in relation to the government push to for constitutional recognition, yet they just trample on our rights, they just treat us with such disdain and contempt? How do you feel about being expected to participate in something like the constitutional recognition discussion and then the resulting referendum?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely against constitutional reform. I don't think anyone has a right to include us into a foreign constitution, let's be honest. It's a foreign constitution coming from another country and being created in our land to bring us under their law. And this could effectively cede our sovereign right to be people in our own country. It could take away all our rights. As soon as they say we're in the constitution, we're equal to everyone else, does that mean all Aboriginal funding will be removed because we're seen as equal? They've taken $570 million out of last year's budget away from Aboriginal affairs. So this is only going to further create the divide between black and white, if I must. Mm. And I don't believe it's going to be a good thing for any of us. Like I always say to people, if people recognise that this is Aboriginal land and we are the traditional owners of this land, shouldn't it really be us writing a constitution to include foreigners into our country, not foreigners writing a constitution to include us into our own country? It really makes no sense, does it?
It doesn't make a lot of sense when you put it like that, brother.
Well, that's one of the main ways I've been able to get people to understand what they're doing. It is our country. Why shouldn't we be sitting at these forums and rewriting a constitution that we agree on, that we'd be willing to be a part of and include them into our country?
Yeah.
I think that should have been done in the first place. But, I mean, of course, they wouldn't give us a full education up until, the late 60s, early 70s. So, it's a generation now, the 40-plus have been allowed a full education, and 40 and under, I should say, that have been allowed the full education and can now start to make these demands and on the government and make them see that this is ours. You've only come here, as aliens, and now you're enforcing your laws upon us. We've always had the law of the land here, our own laws, And, I mean, even in the Bible it says, live under the law of the land in which you live. So why would they come with the Bible and then go against it?
Yeah, come with the Bible and hand it over, swap the Bible for the land. We got the Bible and they got the land. But anyway, one question that I didn't put to you, that I didn't ask you about, and you don't have to answer, but I'm just wondering what your observations around Port Augusta, or how you personally feel about the this outrageous attacks on Adam Goods.
I think Adam Goods, what he done was great.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows a continuing of culture. You know, it may be a contemporary type dance. It's obviously not a traditional thing, but my father actually says that culture isn't stagnant.
That's right.
It's dynamic. So it does change. It evolves. It adapts with other things around it, and which is why we put down the stone axe and picked up the steel axe. You know, we've adapted and evolved our culture to a point where, you know, we can be proud of still holding on to something. And I think Adam Goods showed that really well by his little war dance he done the other day. It was just that pride of holding on to, you know, what culture we've got. They've tried to destroy our culture, let's be honest. So we've got to hold on to every little bit we've got left. And whether that means making up new dances and evolving those into the everyday psyche as Aboriginal culture, I think we should go for it.
Yeah. Were you surprised? I mean, did it come as a surprise for you, the way the racists came out and just attacked him? I mean, former Australian of the Year and stuff, and brilliant sports person, AFL player and stuff, you know, very humble, non-offensive sort of a man. He does his business with pride and integrity and stuff. Did it surprise you?
Well, to be honest, racism doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the everyday Australian way of life. I mean, before all those race vilification laws were in, I mean, it was an everyday thing to call your Greek or your Italian friend,
that's right,
your wog mate, you
that's
know,
right,
your Aboriginal friend, your Abbo mate, and so on and so on. So these things, I think they see racism or, you know, racism can be seen as almost an everyday part of life in the wider society, where... So I wasn't shocked, I suppose.
Yeah.
But just the fact that they came out against something as small as that, I remember going to the NRL Indigenous Games up there on the Gold Coast for the first one and seeing the war cry there, and I thought it was great, you know? And when the Aboriginal team played against the Maoris, I think it was as well.
That's right.
A few years back, they done another war cry there against the Haka, and these things were well received. So for there's so many people to come out against Adam Goods doing a personal war cry himself, it just defied sort of explanation. It's just
common sense, eh? Common sense, yeah. Yep. Well, brother, look, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. I better let you get back to your job. You'd have the boss on your back. If he's anything like our boss, he'll be on your back in no time.
Actually, I've got a really good boss, and he's actually realises that I am a spokesman for my tribes, and I've got a lot to do culturally. So, and he's given me the job and said you can do these things. We're not going to try and stop.
Good on you.
Doing your cultural thing, so...
No, that's good to have an understanding, boss.
I'm really impressed with these mob, yeah.
That's good. No, I'm just a bit of tongue-in-cheek. I'm the boss here, so I've got to... But, hey, thanks for that, man, and we'll talk again. I'll give you a buzz and get some updates from Port Augusta on developments over there.
Yeah, no problem at all.
You have a good day. Thank you for your time.
You too. Thanks, Zach.
Bye now. There's Stephen Atkinson giving us an update on Shutdown Australia. Here's Vic Sims with Strange in My Country. And straight after Vic Sims, we'll have Dale Rusker talking to us from over there, Dunwich Way, Stradbroke, talking to us about some of the issues that he's concerned about. Now, stolen wages meetings. One was in Townsville yesterday. Today at 4 o'clock, Rockhampton will at the QCU building is a meeting to discuss stolen wages, to try to put together an advisory committee, a task force, Stolen Wages Reparations Task Force, to assist the Queensland government with the continuing claims for stolen wages claimants in Queensland. So get on down to the meetings. 4 o'clock in Rockhampton today at the QCU building in 110 Campbell Street, Rockhampton. Tomorrow in Mackay, Marbo Day tomorrow, also in the QCU building in 41 Brisbane Street, Mackay. And on Thursday is here in Brisbane at the QCU building here in Peel Street, Level 2, 16 Peel Street, at 10 a.m. Thursday, 10 a.m. here in Brisbane, stolen wages meeting. And then Cairns on Friday this week at 4 p.m. in the Serbian Cultural and Information Centre, 67 Greenslope Street, Edge Hill. Members of the community are encouraged to attend and have your say and see that we can do the right thing by our mob that weren't paid their proper wages and try and get this this $20 million out to the people who deserve it, who should be rightfully paid proper wages. And we know that they're not being paid proper wages in this case, but it's an attempt to recognise that wrongdoing and give people a pittance of an amount of money, nowhere near what they may have lost under the policies of not paying First Nations people. And like I said previously, there's a couple of issues here. People need to raise the issue of responsibility, responsibility of proving the proof that you weren't paid. The governments should be doing that. It shouldn't be. The onus of proof should not be on claimants at all. And if it is on claimants, it should be suffice to sign a statutory declaration. That's one of the key things. And the other one is that claimants, deceased members of family, deceased members of families who did experience stolen wages, their families should be able to claim. There's just a couple of things that should be discussed. My guest now is the Deputy Chair of the Aboriginal Provisional Government, known as the APG, Dale Rusker, talking to me. Dale, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Tiger. Thanks again for having me, and thanks to all your listeners for hearing me.
Tell us your mob, your country.
I'm Stradbroke Island mob, Gurrumpal Guri. My family's are the Morton and Rusker families of this area. My country's the Moreton Bay and Bay Islands, which my people are the original First Nations owners of.
All right. Now, you've got a... want to talk about the rights of residency and forced removal. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I'd just like to acknowledge and compliment the previous speaker and all of the efforts that have been displayed by our people nationally over the last few months and the reinvigoration of our cause, the First Nations people's cause, to move towards trying to get proper justice for us as the original occupants of this country, now known as Australia. The issue relating to residents is one that's become an obvious national reality to our people when we just look at the proposals to forcefully close and remove our peoples from the communities which they've resided on since in a lot of cases a time of antiquity. For many, many millenniums they've been connected to these countries, and now all of a sudden through proposed common law proposals of Australian government on the supposed basis of those communities being economically unsustainable or unviable, they're now being threatened with being shut down and forcefully removed. And when we consider this is a major abuse of our human rights as the original First People, and it's also abuse of principles defined clearly in the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. I've just got so much to say, Tog, I've just got to try and talk so fast with very little time. If I could just refer to a couple of those principles. If we look at Article 7.2, Indigenous people have the collective right to live in freedom, peace and security as distinct peoples and shall not be subjected to any forced act of genocide or any other act of violence, including forcefully removing children of the group to any other group. And then Article 8, Section 2C, any form of forced population transfer, which has the aim, or firstly it starts, the state shall provide effective mechanisms for prevention of and redress for. Section C, any form of forced population transfer which has the aim or effect of violating or undermining any of our rights. Then Article 10, Indigenous people shall not be forcefully removed from their lands or territories. No relocation shall take place without the free and prior and informed consent of the Indigenous people concerned and after an agreement on just and fair compensation and where possible with the option of return. So these abuses are obviously abuses of our international rights as the First Nations people. Just with regards to it, what we've proposed over here from Stradbroke, and it's the proposals coming from our First Nation basis, and it's based on our ancient connection to our country through blood inheritance, is that we need a new form of title, a title that recognises our right to reside freely on our own land, and a form of title that's not sellable and can never ever be removed. And it's a title that's reflective of our ancient customary titles, which can only be owned through residence and transferred down through families of the family of residence. And I think that's something that the nation needs to consider fully, because it's one of the very first basic principles of our human rights, to be able to live on our own land. And if we look at this country and the rapid rate of democratic population increase, and also the value of land property sales in this country and all of the international investments that are occurring... The future doesn't look too good for us in just being able to own and live freely in our own place that we've lived in for many, many millennia. So it's something that we need to put a lot of emphasis on as the original first people of this country.
Mm. Yeah. And with the APG, what's the thoughts of the APG?
Well, if just before I get to that, if I could just talk about just briefly with regards to what's being proposed by government, and I hear a lot of other things that are being proposed by some prominent Indigenous speakers and leaders from around the country in relation to recognition and constitutional reform. And I hear on the radio it being stated that recognition has 85 to 87% of the Aboriginal people's support. And I'd just like to just comment on that one quickly. If people come to Stradbroke Island and asked all of the Aboriginal people over here what they think about recognition, I think there'd be probably 85% of them would turn around and ask, well, what's that? What's that mean? They know very little about it. And the same thing applies to the proposed constitutional reform. And like the previous speaker said, like, this isn't our constitution, it's a foreign constitution that's been imposed on us. It's a very racially discriminating constitution that's been written by a colonial body and a colonial authority on behalf of their colonial rule and control of our place and ourselves. And it doesn't reflect our values and our principles as the original First Nations people that have been occupying this land for many tens of millenniums prior to the colonies' claims through Australian nationhood. As far as constitutional reform goes, I'm totally opposed to it, and I think that the people need to be given fair and equal, adequate opportunity to be able to respond as the original first people as to what it is that we want and whether we want to be a part of this constitution at all or whether we want to have our First Nationhood recognised. And talking about constitution, I think that we need to even consider and be given the opportunity, and if we're not given it, we need to take that opportunity for ourselves to possibly develop up our own original First Nations people's constitution, which could come after possibly our development of our own treaty, the treaty that binds us together as an original nationality of the first people of this land. I often think about the cost that our people and our country has faced as a result of colonialism, and those costs are still being felt right up to this date as a result of the imposed controls and administration of Australian common law over ourselves and our place. And those costs for us, they're extreme, and they're costs that can never, ever be compensated or repatriated or, repaired fully for us through reparation because of the extent of those costs when we consider what's occurred throughout time, starting from the early days, the dispersals, displacements, massacres, the stolen generations, the stolen wages you were just talking about, the stolen land, the stolen economy. And now we're faced with high rates of incarceration, high youth suicide rates, high mental health issues, high unemployment, all these things that have resulted from the times before, which has imposed moral trauma onto our people. And it's had a big impact on us as the society belonging to the original first people of this land. And these costs for our people, they're phenomenal, and they're costs that are still being felt till this date, and we're having and being forced to just sit back and recognise that this other authority that's been imposed on us has these entitlements to be able to control our lives and every aspect of our lives, but also control and reap the benefits of our lands that's belonged to us from ancient times. And I don't accept those costs as being something that's just got to be put in the past, like leave the past in the past, like just forget it and let's get on with now. I can't accept that my people of the past, my land, could just be written off as a form of more or less colonial collateral, because that's just too important to me as an original First Nations man. And I also feel that we need to be given, or if not given, take the opportunity for ourselves to facilitate our own independent process, a process which is looking at, firstly, our nationality, Aboriginal nationality, and the originality of that nationality and what that means to us as the first people. So these are things which I feel are really important, and I don't feel we're going to get the resolve of proper justice from going down the process of recognition or constitutional reform. I believe once constitutional reform takes place and it's implemented then as the basis of law for this country, that's going to secure and validate totally the rights and entitlements of this country as a colony and its democratic nation and their entitlements to our place and all benefits of our place, including our natural wealth and the exploitation of that wealth and the control of the economy that's generated from that wealth and the economy which we're denied. And that's just a major crime of injustice that's continued to be committed against us as First People. Through the Aboriginal Provisional Government, we're looking at trying to develop alternative ways which are reflective of us as the original First People. We're not a part of Australian parliamentary government. We don't get no funding from that government. We're a totally independent First Nations body. We're not an incorporated body, as a lot of people would already know if they understand about the Aboriginal Provisional Government. It's been reinvigorated recently by the involvement of a lot of the First Nations youth or younger people from around the country. And that reinvigoration, that's really important to us, because from that we see this mass mobilisation occurring around our country to voice our discontent against the way we're being treated as the original First People of this country by Australian parliaments and its common law controls over our place and ourselves. So through the APG, we're trying to make endeavours, and again, considering we are unincorporated, unfunded, so it's all based on our own self-efforts, but we're establishing subcommittee working groups under the APG, and we're expanding on the APG's roles and responsibilities. We're establishing subcommittees to look at progressing the development of a declaration that was put out recently relating to our national identity and the follow-on from that direct declaration, which could lead into a treaty between all of the original First Nations people, clarifying and giving meaning to our First Nation identity and that First Nations identity's worth and place in this country as the original people. We're also establishing subcommittees to look at how we're going to utilise media networking, so that we can get the stories of the people out. One good example of that that's already existing, that's only come recently, is Black Nations Rising magazine that's put out from the members of the Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance. And I compliment that magazine because it's a very good media tool getting the stories out. We're also looking at establishing a legal advisory committee under the APG, and we've got a lot of interest expressed on that already from young professional legal experts who are Indigenous people as well, First Nations people of this land, and that advisory committee will be looking at our rights of First Nationhood from the perspective of the United Nations entitlements of law, and looking at how this country's law actually degenerates our First Nation entitlements and the faults and failures of this country's law against ourselves as the original First People. So that's going to be interesting also. And then we're also looking at establishing an international working group that campaigns internationally on behalf of the Aboriginal people of this country and their First Nationhood, and tries to engage other countries in our call and cause for recognition of our originality as First People of this land. So there's a lot of things occurring throughout the Aboriginal Provisional Government at the moment, and we're also going to be trying to unify all of the groups that are making sovereign assertions around the country on the basis of their First Nationhood. And hopefully through those groups becoming unified, we'll be able to establish a more national unified approach, which will not so much benefit us from within the constraints of Australian common law, but will give us entitlements from the benefits of United Nations law as a nation that should be recognised being the First People of this place. So that's just some of the things that I wanted to share with you and with all of your listeners.
It appears one of the big challenges is the lack of resources. I mean, no funds, trying to coordinate just discussions, meetings, because one of the big issues is that our mob don't get to hear any alternatives. Who gets to put up an option? Noel Pearson. Who else has put up options, you know? So one of the big issues is just that lack of resources. But the options, the opportunity to sit around and talk and identify what the issues are, that's a major issue, is it not?
That is a major issue, and it's an option that we've been continuously denied since the colony has been founded, and I believe it's an option that Australian common law and Australian Parliament does not want to facilitate, because they want to retain full control and power in relation to this country, and they don't want to recognise any First Nationhood existence prior to that, and what we should be entitled to as the original people. And when we consider the fact in relation to the funding, this is a land that's been stolen off us. The economy that's generated to this land could be considered as being criminal proceeds. And we're denied access to any of the economic benefits of our land apart from what the governments are willing to hand us by way of funding. And by them doing that, they're able to retain us in a state of conscience which is dependent on welfare, on the welfare of the government, on what they're willing to give us. And we need to shift our emphasis, and we need to realise and accept that we are the First People. We are the original owners of the place. And that ownership means we own all aspects of our place's originality, including all of the natural resource wealth that is a part of our country that's now exploited foreignly, and it has an economic benefit to foreign controls and foreign bodies. And none of the equality of that economic benefit comes back to ourselves. We don't even give approval for it to occur, and it happens. So we're denied any form of economic justice as a deliberate means of being able to restrain our developments as the First People. So it's a deliberate mechanism that's been employed against us as a result of colonial control and common law authority. And we need to think about this when we're considering things such as constitutional reform. And is this going to give us this sort of recognition, or is it going to give us any form of economic empowerment, or is it going to deny us these opportunities totally and put us in the place fully forever as being only 3% of the democratic population of this country who has shared an equal entitlement to the rest of the democratic nation? So that's a big concern to me as original First Nations man.
Mm-hmm. If you bring the focus back to your community, Stradbroke Island, you got a native title determination, and that's got some support in the community, and it's, there are others in the community. I think you don't necessarily support native title. I'm not a big fan of native title myself. But there is recognition there, and when we're talking about constitutional recognition, is that something? Is that something to take to the community, to sit around and discuss the fact that there is recognition, here's native title, we've got some rights here, we can do this, this and this. I mean, just to look at some of the issues of your immediate community and family in trying to deal with some of the stuff there.
Well, most definitely, that needs to be considered. As far as opinions go, there's differing opinions like there is right across the country relating to what's advantageous to us as people. Some of the people believe that native title is a big advantage and benefit, but then there is a significant portion of the people that's saying, look, I'm one that says it from here, well, what has it given us?
Mm-hmm.
What has native title given us? Like, it was made out to be a magnificent, big national accomplishment, but it hasn't really changed much for us over here on the island, and it hasn't really given us the guarantee of security or economic stability as the original First People. What I believe, and I say this with all due respect to all of the people who have endeavoured to make the effort to have their native title real, but when I consider it, and I consider it fully from my experience and involvement throughout a process that has taken nearly 20 years plus, native title is about validating the rights and interests of the Australian common law, and the validation of it is about acknowledging their authority and their right to be able to control ourselves and our place and the whole benefits of the economy that it generates from our place. And native title is only about the rights that government are willing to recognise. And many of those rights are very minimal, and they don't really give us any advantageous benefits at all as the original First People. And I'm a firm believer in our First Nationhood, and I believe that we have this ancient right that comes from an ancient connection to country through blood inheritance, which is resolved through an ancient law, our ancient customary law, which has existed for millenniums prior, and it allowed for us to enjoy and benefit with control over our places as original First People. Native title takes all that away from us, and it takes us one step closer towards Australia in its colonial nation state gaining full authority and control over our places and all of the wealth within it. And it takes us, again, another step closer to full validation through the next stage being proposed through constitutional reform. And I think I've mentioned in the past, in one of the previous Let's Talks, like when we look at our mobilisation throughout our history to display our discontent or disagreement against abuses that are being facilitated against us as the original First People by way of protest, we've been able to mobilise en masse, and in the past we haven't been able to give full and thorough meaning to that mobilisation by way of documenting it and making the legal national position. So what's resulted from it is the outcome has been organised for us by government and through parliamentary processes, and then it's imposed back down upon us as a part of this nation, as the minority group of this nation being the less than 3%. And our organisation is done for us. I think now we need to take responsibility fully for ourselves and make sure that through our mobilisation and our action, we are organising clear meaning, which defines thoroughly what our mobilisation is about and what it is that we want as the original First People resulting from our efforts.
Mm-hmm. It appears to me, and I've always thought this, that it's a two-pronged attack or we've got to mobilise on the ground. People on Stradbroke have to get around, sit around, talk, and they can talk about the native title and what they can go in and take, not what's been offered, what's been given. What can they go in and take from that native title, from the fact of their recognition? But that's only an example of community sitting down talking. So my point is, one, we need mob sitting down in community, grassroots sitting down, be it Musgrave Park, Jagera, be it over there amongst your Gurrumpul mob there sitting down talking. And aligned with that, it has to happen at a national level, as you speak about the APG and mobilisation across the country. How do we get that happening? I mean, it is essential that the voice comes from the community, comes from the grassroots, that people at the grassroots level understand exactly what constitutional recognition is about, understand exactly what native titles offering Gurrumpul mob, and what they can do. Is that the way to go? Like, we need to be sitting down talking and mobilising on the ground?
Oh, absolutely. And in our mobilising ourselves on the ground, we need to be able to consider what it is that we are and what it is that that means. And from the meaning of it, what it is that we're entitled to. And is it that we just have to accept what's on offer as a result of colonialism and colonial control? Or is it something that more that we're entitled to as the original First People of this place? And if it is something more that we are entitled to, what is it then that we need to be able to do to be able to receive that entitlement and have it recognised and respected? And I feel that it has to be a grassroots process, and we need to be able to consider it fully from a point and a free state of mind, one that's not influenced and controlled as a result of imposition of colonial authority and what's on offer. It has to be considered from the context of our originality, and that's something that we've been denied. And if we can take that opportunity for ourselves, and it's not going to happen overnight, and we can't necessarily think that it's going to resolve before the proposed 2017 referendum leading up to the proposed constitutional changes. It's taken over 200 years for us to be put into this state. It's going to take years now for us to move ourselves out of this state, and it's something that may take, like if we look at other countries around the world that have moved towards reclaiming their independence, it's taken them decades to be able to accomplish, but in many cases they've got there, and they've got their First Nationhood recognised and respected and accepted. And that's something that we need to be given the opportunity to consider as whether it's a possible solution for ourselves, alternative to what's being proposed through imposition of Australian common law and parliamentary processes.
Yes. Yes, no, we've got a lot of work to do.
We have. And just considering that, what I've tried to do through the Aboriginal Provisional Government with the support of all of the members is to create a beginning point, a point that as a nation we could start from in just getting agreement to one basic principle. And that one basic principle, if I could just have a minute in a sec just to...
You've got less than a minute. We're about news time.
Okay, well, it's a declaration of Aboriginal nationality. We make this declaration to reinitiate our own independent process as Aboriginal people in developing an organised and united position in the ongoing fight to take our place among the nations and peoples of the world, not beneath them. We, the Aboriginal people, are the original owners of the land now known as Australia. Our ownership over these lands is inherited through our ancestral bloodline connection to country and our ancient systems of customary law. Our customary law binds us together through common principles and values of national identity. Our national identity entitles us to all the rights afforded to any nation. Being a nation entitles us to continue administering our ancient customary law to decide and control the future of our lands and our lives. Our system of customary law bestows upon us our own unique national identity, totally separate to and not recognised by the colonial Australian state. We, the Aboriginal nations, do not accept colonial Australian law and its claims to authority and control over our people and our lands. We, the original...
Brother, that's time's up for me. I've got to move on with the news. Thanks for joining us there.